Is fine-tuning an argument for a creator? My answer in the beginning and in the end will be yes. But a question I handled during preparation is, how strong is the argument? How strong? And I'll present you a person, historical person. I learned from him recent few years, and you'll see it's interesting. He was really interested in the nature around us, in details, really in details. He recognized the complex systems, and he recognized also the interactions we have heard yesterday. But his position, he don't use it in the way to conclude from what he is watching. He didn't conclude there is a creator. And I want to show you what are the frames of this. The line I want to talk are similar to what Thomas did us yesterday with an historical example, watching a man doing his research and how he used what he is watching for concluding what should I think about a creator. The man I want to talk about, he was interested in the beginning of very simple chemicals, gases, carbon dioxide, water, and he was astonished about the characterization of these molecules, about these materials in a chemical way, but also in physiology. And he is interested in systems, in bigger systems. This is cut through an erythrocyte, the red blood cells. My position, my background, I'm working with this organization in Germany. We have a slogan, science in a created world. And the name of the organization, both topics, the Bible, the Word of God, and our knowledge to do science, which enable us to do science. But in this order, in the first place, the Word of God, what He shows us in His Word, and knowledge to use the gift of our mind God gifted to us, and to ask very serious questions. Lawrence Henderson, these are his dates. This is the man I like to present you. I want to give you some biographical lines to show how, what's about his scientific working and development of his thinking. The main book where we would look on is this book, The Fitness of Environment. This is a book of similar he wrote some years later. And at the end, we will reflect on fine-tuning as an indication. And that's, I prefer this term, an indication for a creator. In the days when Lawrence Henderson was, there was around knowledge about what we are talking here. Science and faith are not opponents. And one thing he knows very well is William Paley with his natural theology. This was well known in these days. Also, that Charles Darwin knows this very well, and he grew up with this knowledge. You know this book from William Paley, published in 1802, the famous argument about the watchmaker. If you find this in the field, it may direct you thinking there should be a watchmaker. A lot of people know about this argumentation. In our days, it's heavily criticized also, but it's still an argument in the field. Another idea, another knowledge people know in these days are the Bridgewater treatises. This is from he gives money when he died, and scientists, mainly theologians in their days, but they are experts in different sciences, and they are writing for lay people. That means in an understandable way that scientific knowledge made the faith, the belief in God, stronger. It fits. And this was the aim. Therefore, he gave the money. Let's write books for people to see this will fit each other. Lawrence Henderson was born in Massachusetts in the USA. His father was a merchant, and he himself wrote the main influence during his growing up was by his mother, not by his father. And his mother, there are some biographic remarks which characterize her marked ability and independence of character. She was brought up in a strong Calvinistic family. A brother of her, that means an uncle of Lawrence, was a pastor, but his mother wrote when she was adult, she wrote, "Theology is a thing which in the last 2,000 years has caused more misery and suffering, woe of body and mind, in the world than almost anything else, unless perhaps the inordinate pursuit of riches and power. I have hated creeds since I was a child." That means that's the atmosphere in which he grew up. And in my opinion, this is, we have to think about if we see what he's thinking when he is a scientist, when he draws his conclusions from what is the research. This is the position of his mother. And in some respect, he is explicitly telling, "I am an agnostic," when he was adult. And here is one root for this way of thinking. He had two younger brothers, twins, and one of this twin died in infancy. And one point in his youth during school was this brother, who was still living and grow up, was ill, and he was visiting school, and he established a small laboratory at home and gave him chemistry. He gave him chemistry lessons, being himself at the college, but he teaches his younger brother in chemistry. In the age of 16, he entered Harvard College And this is an institution where he is during his whole life. He entered in the age of 16 Harvard College, and his active interest was in physics and physical chemistry. You have to think about physical chemistry was not an established in these days, not a well-established discipline. It's still in the beginning, in the first days, but he was fascinated about this topic. And did also experiments in his college times in these fields. He finished within 4 years, and he tried to learn to study biochemistry, what we nowadays call biochemistry. But what he likes to do is to learn physical chemistry and to introduce it in physiology, because he thought this is the way we can do science in biology, not only complex and to describe the structure, but to understand in a scientific way. He thought this is the way to introduce physical chemistry into physiology. And therefore he decided entering Harvard Medical School, and he didn't like chemistry. He didn't like medicine, and his dream was not fulfilled. And he didn't like to become a physicist in the medical way. And he did during his study there, he was doing other things. He was interested in. Also, he finished the medical study, but he decided he'll never become a medical doctor. When he finished his studies at Harvard Medical School, he went for 2 years to Europe. He entered the laboratory of Franz Hofmeister at the university in Strasbourg, at these days a German area, and the university there was he was doing biochemistry, and Henderson hoped there really to realize his dreams, and he got the task in characterization of hemoglobin, but he was not really good in doing experiments. He was more doing theoretical problem to count data and to summarize them and to look for principles. And so he was not too happy in this laboratory. He wrote in his memories, the best what he get from this time is the connections. He know other people, and he was traveling around in Europe. He did some, there was a publication on hemoglobin, but it was not his main interest in doing this. And then he's going back to the US, Harvard Medical School, and entered the laboratory of Richard. We see him a few minutes later. And he stayed his whole life at Harvard University. He entered here this laboratory. This was his beginning. And he became an instructor, became assistant professor in biological chemistry, and a regular professor. And he ended up in the Abbot James Lawrence Professor Chair in Chemistry at Harvard University. To me, it was interesting. Harvard University, it was established in 1636, is named after John Harvard, a clergyman, and in a document from 1943, there is written about the purpose of this institution: to advance learning and perpetuate the posterity, treating to leave an illiterate ministry when our present ministers shall lie in the dust. There is an old seal which is on documents when students have finished their, and there is around this logo Christo et Ecclesiae. At this institution, I don't know if anybody is like to do this today, to use seals as in those days. He was there at this institution. Let's look about some publications from him. In the beginning, he is interested in physical chemistry, and in 1905, he published a review about combustion heat of chemical substances. And the main, and therefore maybe some of you may know him, his name in 1908, publication about acid-base equilibria. He studied this in the beginning as a physical chemical system in the laboratory, but he was interested in the organism, in physiology, and looks at this. He tried to recognize how did it work in bodies, in animals, in living beings. And he did research on buffer systems. In 1913, he wrote the book, The Fitness of the Environment, an inquiry in the biological significance of the properties of matter. When he was writing this book, he was convinced Darwinism, he knows very well, and he agreed with this. And he used this term, he decided to use this term, but he recognized very well, we will see it in quotes afterwards, he knows very well the effect of adaption of organisms belonging to variation and selection pressure is not a mechanism working here. This mechanism, in his mind, are only working if you have organisms. But he is writing about the environment. That means the framework which give the lines the organism have to adapt to. But he recognized very well the environment is not an easy one. There are substances very well designed, very well fits he used the word teleology. He used this word, and he got a lot of criticism because of using this word. 4 years later, he was writing the other book I mentioned, The Order of Nature, the same line. And afterwards, in the 1920s, he published a lot of papers in physiology of blood, also using exactly these data he got from the laboratory applied in physiology. His interests are, this is sometimes the case if people are very geniusly, he was at the end of his career, he was interested in sociology. He translated this work of an Italian scientist in this area, and he also was interested in philosophy, and he started at Harvard University, he started lectures about history of science. Also, his view was very, very broad. Josiah Gibbs, he was, in his mind, he was the one who established physical chemistry. And he impressed Henderson very much. And his thinking is, I will follow this way and apply this knowledge in physiology, in living organisms, to serve myself in growing the knowledge, the scientific knowledge. He thinks this is really necessary. This is a possible way. These are the main things, main things. You know, the phase rules from Gibbs, or the multiphase systems. This term is coined in physical chemistry by Josiah Gibbs. And he is really famous in establishing physical chemistry, and he was a hero in the thinking of Henderson. This is, I told you, Theodore Richards. He has a lab when Henderson come back from Strasbourg to Harvard, and he entered his lab and did some work there. And Richards got in 1914 the Nobel Prize for exact determinations of the atomic weights. This is the surrounding where he was doing research, people like this. This was also a professor, Josiah Royce, and he did philosophy at Harvard University, and Henderson visited his seminars and learned logic and philosophical thinking with him. He didn't agree with his positions, but in the discussions he learned thinking, he learned philosophy, and they got friends. And during many, many years, he was visiting the seminars and in discussion with Josiah Royce. Later on a Congress of Physiology, he met this man, Christian Bohr, is a physiologist, a Danish physiologist, the father of the well-known Nobel Prize winner Niels Bohr. His father was a physiologist, and Henderson met him in conferences, and they stay in contact and discuss about the blood, about physiological problems in connection with physical chemical data. I've said in 1908 there was the publication of acid-base equilibrium in organisms and the phosphate and carbonate buffer systems. And this is the equation, maybe some of you may remember, there are some lectures in some days ago. We have this here, you have the name Henderson-Hasselbalch equations about the pH and about the buffer systems to describe them in a mathematical way. They come to this equation, and they improve it together. This is one of the basic equations, chemical reaction, where Henderson was thinking about and recognizing nature is really well established. When he came to know the atoms of carbon, oxygen, and hydrogen, and the molecules they build up, and how these molecules did work in our nature. Water, main substance in the oceans, solubility, or for example, the density correlated to temperature. The well-known fact that the highest density at 4 degrees Celsius, and it's really necessary for nature because otherwise there we will get a lot of problems. And he recognized this seems well designed. And there we have the connection to our top question. This he recognized. And we will see some quotes. But here, first of all, a student of Henderson and a fellow of him in later days, he commented on Henderson's discovery of description of this buffer system. And he wrote, "These basic facts pointed clearly to a teleological order in the universe." Henderson explicitly dissolved any attempt to associate this order with notions of design in nature and considered his view fully compatible with a mechanistic outlook on the problems of biology. This is a commentary of his work, but a commentary from a man who knows him very well. But we like to look in his own, what he is talking about these things. When he was back at Harvard in 1911, he starting lectures in history of science. He was the founder of the American Society of History of Science together with this man. And in his book, The Fitness of the Environment, he wrote, "The actual environment is really the best of all possible environments for life." This remembers me to another man, reminds me to another man, a German philosopher, Leibniz. He got the same idea and used it as proof for the existence of God. He constructed an argument with this knowledge. The world is the best environment, the best of all possible environments for life. And for him, for Leibniz, it's a proof for the existence of God. And Henderson is an example and shows us this is not a thought which is impressed, which should be taken from this knowledge. Not necessarily. But these are two possibilities to think, to have the same knowledge, the same impression, the same thought and evaluation of the facts they saw, but different consequences, different ways of thinking about. In this book, fitness of the environment, Henderson wrote, "There is in truth no one chance in countless millions of millions that the many unique properties of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, and especially of their stable compounds, water and carbon acid, which chiefly make up the atmosphere of a new planet, should simultaneously occur in the three element, in the three elements, otherwise than thought the operation of a natural law which somehow connects them together. There is no greater probability that these unique properties should be without due cause uniquely favorable to the organic mechanism. These are no mere accidents. An explanation is to seek. I must admit, however, that no explanation is at hand." This is the decision to solve this, to handle this knowledge, to draw conclusions. His idea is, this is what I recognize in the world. These are the data. And my conclusion is, there should be a mechanism. There should be a mechanism. He said, it's not an accident. Impossible. The statistics is against it. There is no probability to get this by chance. He is sure. This is sure for him. But he decided, there is no more accident. An explanation is to seek, and an explanation in his mind is a mechanism, a natural, a scientific mechanism to find. What's the details? For example, the solubility of carbon dioxide in water. Also today in the discussion of CO2, it's really necessary, and there is one solution to press CO2 in big deep depth in the ocean. And this is a technical possibility. If it's a good idea is another question, but it's a physical possibility. And also it's really fine-tuned if you go with this knowledge into physiology in the blood. For you have aqueous systems in our cells, and you have a very fine-tuned balance between oxygen and carbon dioxide in our cells, for to load on the erythrocytes the oxygen to transport it from the lungs to the cells, and there you have an exchange, and the partial pressure difference of this is very, very small. But it functions all the day in general. And from a chemical, from a physical chemical point of view, it's astonishing. Really. It's fascinating that it works. And this is the reason behind this. He recognized this very well. And he's no possibility for an accident. But he said there should be a mechanism why this happens in that way. And he is very honest to finish this quote. "I must admit, however, that no explanation is at hand." And as long as this is the case, it hardens, it makes the idea, the conclusion to a creator stronger. But as a scientist, you have to say, you can have the hope there will be an explanation. But until the days of Henderson, no mechanism is found. That doesn't prove anything. but it makes the idea stronger that maybe there is no mechanism to be found. There is maybe, as we heard yesterday from Andy, a creator, a designer found. Maybe. He wrote further in this book, "At length, we have reached the conclusion which I was concerned to establish. Science has finally put the old teleology to death. Its disembodied spirit feed from vitalism and all material ties. Immortal alone lives on, and from such a ghost, science has nothing to fear. The man of science is not even obliged to have an opinion concerning its reality, for it dwells in another world where he, as a scientist, can never enter." Here we recognize he know very well Paley and what I've told you in the what I've shown you in the beginning. He knows very well, and he realized to use the term is very dangerous to him, very dangerous to him. And he got a lot of criticism because of the, using this. And therefore, this is his defense to specify his positions, to say, this is an idea, but I use the term in another way, in a scientific way, not in the way Paley or others intended to do. This is the way he is handling with this. But the recognition, what he knows, what is the result of his research, intended him to use this term. That means what we have yesterday heard from Thomas, that a lot of colleagues, a lot of students nowadays are not able to be fascinated about the details they recognize in nature. It's not valid to him. He recognized it very well. He was fascinated. He was amazed by what he was seeing. And he recognized it's not by chance. And nevertheless, he didn't draw the conclusion there should be design behind that all. But I think he was very honest, very clear. He told what are his positions, how he was thinking. And this is very nice to me. You can follow his arguments and recognize what is going on in his mind and how he hurdled with some problems and with some critics. In the other book, which is similar to the fitness of nature, the order of nature, he used usage of what he've learned from Gibbs. And he wrote there very often, the organism is an autonomous unit in which every part is functionally related to every other and exists in a servant as the servant of the whole. That means he have, in a way, a dualistic view of life. And that's what he is doing, but he knows very well this position, this classical position he copied in this work. A quote from an historical of science, he is a recent scientist in history of science, and he wrote a biography or some essays about Henderson, and he wrote, the emphasis in his work was always on the need to examine whole systems. Whole systems, and to avoid the error of assuming that the whole was merely the sum of its parts, what we have read just before. This was the direction of his thinking, to start with physical chemistry, with easy systems. Not everybody would agree, easy systems, because they are really complex and it's hard to describe them in a mathematical way. But they're easy if you compare it to physiology, because there are the surrounding is much more complex. The system as a whole is unimaginable complex. But he knows this is the direction where we should go in our research if we like to understand nature in a scientific way. And therefore he ended up in his later career with a study of blood. This physical chemical knowledge he had gathered during doing science in a biological context in physiology, and he wrote there a lot of papers and wrote a textbook, Blood, a Study in General Physiology. And there he recognized, and this is what we today know, this buffer system, carbon dioxide and water, about 50% of the buffer capacity in our blood is on this belonging to the system. Hemoglobin, also a buffer system, because you can, this molecule, you know, might maybe from biology lessons, to be loaded with oxygen. This also can be loaded with a proton, and we have also a buffer system. It belongs around 35% of the summed up buffer capacity of the blood. Other proteins and phosphate also around 5% of the buffer capacity of the blood. And he was a pioneer in looking after this aspects. Each of this is a special buffer system, and you have them united in our blood in a really complex, a complex total system, the blood. Now there is an interesting thing. Henderson write in the years 36 to 38 memories, but never published. These memories are typed sheets and in the archive in Harvard University. And they are not published, but I recognized they are cited. That means there should be a way to get them. And I asked there, and they told me I have to fill a form and to give reasons why I should use them, for which aim, and so on. And I forgot that I asked for these copies. Three months later, I got an email from Harvard University, and they said to me, okay, your arguments are valid. You will get, and I got an code to download this, but I have to sign, don't give it in other hands, and you have to cite it by this code. And it was a new experience. I never had something like that. But I was really happy to have this. And Henderson wrote in his memories, for he did this writing as an experiment. He tried as a very well experienced scientist, how is his knowledge growing? He tried to think, What was the beginning and how is it? For this writing was an experiment, and I'll show you some quotes from these memories. He wrote in these memories, supposing that the compounds of phosphorus have been introduced into the composition of a living organism by a process of natural selection, each one in accordance with its particular properties, comfortably to the simple theory of natural selection. What is to be said about the usefulness of the substance that seemed to be inevitable as products of phosphorus metabolism? Is this usefulness an accident? Or if not, what is the explanation? We see he feel the problems. On the bicarbonate buffer, if carbon dioxide were either an insoluble or high soluble gas, that's what we talked just before to explain this system, its mobility in nature, the function of the lungs, the respiratory functions in the blood, and the countless other physiological properties in animals and plants would have been very different from what they are, and so far as I could see, would be in any conceivable case much less effective. That means he recognized it seems to be optimized. To his knowledge, it seems to be optimized. And he recognized this. Or about water, a trivial compound in our days, and we open the line and water is coming out in a good quality. Water, it seems clear that these maxima and minima indicate that water is in every instance a singularly favorable substance in relation to the stability, the complexity, or the metabolism of living organisms. Water is not just a simple dipole molecule. It's optimized in a lot of directions, useful in organisms. I felt, in other words, that water clearly possesses a pattern of qualities, nearly every one of them unique or nearly so in magnitude. And further, that each of these in itself and all of them in cooperation are in many respects extraordinarily favorable for any kind of living organisms of which I could conceive, or, to put it in another way, favorable to extensive and varied trial, relatively numerous success in the trial and error process of organic evolution. What I indicate in the beginning, he was very well aware that if the evolution process really happens, it may only happen with organisms. But nature, the surrounding, the living world for organisms, how should this be optimized? But it seems to be optimized. And he recognized that. And he recognized also it's not one molecule which seems to be optimized, but they are interrelated, water, carbon dioxide. It's a very simple example. But the physical characteristics, they fit. They fit for the surrounding, and they fit for physiology. And he recognized this. About teleology, he wrote, I know more about the literature of teleology and final causes than about natural theology. I was at last, at least vaguely aware that a great part of what had been written on this subject is from scientific standpoint irrelevant, if not nonsense. That means he said what we have seen in the beginning, Paley, Bridgewater treatises, it's not scientific. It's irrelevant to a scientist. He have to do research, physical chemistry, and apply this to physiology. And he is going this way, and he is ignoring these arguments, which he knows from his early education, but he, in his thought, they are irrelevant, if not nonsense. It's a decision. It's a personal decision to decide what's the strength of this part. And he decided this is irrelevant. Here is a remembering of him about fitness. I saw that fitness is a reciprocal relation, that adaptions in the Darwinian sense must be adaptions to something, and that complexity, stability, and the intensity of diversity of metabolism in organisms could not have resulted through adaptions unless there were some sort of pattern in the properties of the environment. That, as I know partly knew, is both intricate and highly singular. That again shows us he knows about the presence of these ideas, of the combinations of these facts. He is very aware of that. But I should prefer a style, and I find those parts of the book in which there is reference to a philosophical discussions in teleology, vitalism, and so forth, more or less irrelevant and immature. I draw the conclusion and stubbornly asserted that such an intricate relation is the kind of thing that calls for scientific explanation, but I also draw the conclusion from my studies and reflection that no explanation could be given, and that I couldn't even think of the possibility of an explanation. Very honest. Years later, when I came to know Alfred Whitehead, a famous philosopher, he told me that he particularly liked the position that I had taken in that I avoided the pitfalls of the teleological view and of the mechanistic view alike, and this has always been a source of satisfaction to me. He is very honest. We very often in the last days quote Romans chapter 1. In my opinion, here, this is in the beginning of the letter Paul is writing to the Christians in Rome. And he wrote about a spiritual view, how reality and thinking in his times, what's about. And he told other Christians who share his spiritual view, he showed this are the connections. God has shown, God's character is visible, his visible attributes, they are clearly seen in creation. And though there is no execution for them, they are responsible. But as we have heard and saw by Henderson, this second part of the argument of Paul, he didn't share. He recognized very well design as indication, but to what? Another biblical quote, and you are also very well known, this we confess. By faith, we understand that the universe is created by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things that are visible. We confess that. That's not a conclusion, not a question of logic. That's a point which I can state as to confess this, I believe. What may have happened with Henderson? I point to the fact of his mother's influencing and his development as a scientist. He established from the classical Christian view, which he was aware of, he knew that, but he decided to go the scientific way, and in his thinking it's in opposition to what faith is going. So I think fine-tuning really is an indication to a designer, but how strong? And I think there are, for our mind, it's possible to look for other reasons. And he decided to set his hope in scientific mechanisms. He is honest enough to say, until now, I have no idea, and until now, there's nothing happens. Nothing, there is no to see, not, nothing to see. But he told, he showed us there that the roots for his decision is a decision he has made. God is nothing for me. I don't want to keep in contact to him. And I think I was really wondering about his honesty. He very clearly shows, these are my thoughts. This is the way I develop my thoughts. And I think, to me, I want to be honest also and say, this is not a conclusion of the indication, a strong conclusion which from the facts I get as a scientist. It's a possible, it's my position. But it's my position because a decision I've made. And Henderson has made another decision. I'll end up with remembering you to a situation which we read of in the Old Testament, the second book of Kings. Elisha is in a city, and his servant in the morning is going out, and the Aramean soldiers closed the ring around the city. And he told to Elisha, no chance. The end is near. We have no possibility. And Elisha, he is talking to God, open him his eyes. Open him his eyes. And that's what I learned from this old story in Jerusalem, which we recognized, we can read in the Bible. It remembers me my task, I think two steps, which I found handling with this subject. First, like Thomas yesterday, I'll try to motivate people to be fascinated, to look very closely what's around us, really closely, and be fascinated about the details. And second, to ask the Lord to be graceful and open their eyes. Because in my opinion, design, the recognition of design may be something which is point to a designer. But if you make another decision, your eyes are blind. And therefore, I think it's a task for Christians to ask God, open their eyes so they can see the army of God is much more, much stronger behind the Aramean soldiers. And I think this is the situation also for us.